So the top Ruby on joint work with Luis Mazanes from Barcelona. And here's a quick outline. So the first part will be on motivation. So I'll tell you why we're interested in having any axioms for quantum theory at all. And the second part will be on the physical setup. So what are the physical assumptions that we put in the beginning. And at the same time, I will tell you what the axioms are and what they mean physically and also what they mean mathematically. The fourth part will be a proof of the main result, which is mainly a derivation of the Hilbert space formalism from the axioms here. And since we only have about 1 hour, I surely cannot go through all the details, but I will try to give you the most important ideas. And in particular, I'll try to explain to you why quantum bits are three-dimensional balls. Then if there's some time left, I'll also try to give you some speculation and some work in progress on theories that are beyond quantum theory that you might get, for example, if you drop some of you weaken some of the axioms. Okay, let me start with a citation by John Wheeler from the New York Times in 2000, where he said that quantum physics has explained the structure of atoms and molecules, the behavior of semiconductors, and the consequences from neutrinos to quarks. And then, successful, yes, but mysterious too. So why does the quantum exist? And this is, of course, a deep question that many of you or us will have come across before. For example, when we learn quantum theory at school. So if you look in the textbooks, you have all these postulates of quantum theory, like you states are vectors in Hilbert space, and that's the Born rule, the unitaries, but how come? So, I mean, why do we have these abstract postulates? And of course, you can say, as also John Wheeler did here, well, it's a very successful theory, so it just works. So why should we ask for these philosophical questions? But then it turns out that it's not just a philosophical question, but a very practical question. And this can be seen with another story. So this is a paper by Steven Weinberg in 1989. And he says this paper presents a general framework for introducing nonlinear corrections into ordinary quantum mechanics that can serve as a guide to experiments that would be sensitive to such corrections. And the title is Testing Quantum Mechanics. So what he does is he suggests some nonlinear modification as an alternative that you can test versus quantum mechanics. And this is, of course, very interesting to do. But then a few months later, there was Nicolas Gisard, who wrote another paper with the title Weinberg's Nonlinear Quantum Mechanics and Supraluminal Communications. So in his paper, he said, we would like in this letter to draw attention to the difficulty of modifying quantum mechanics without introducing arbitrary fast actions at a distance. And then, so below we show how to construct within Weinberg's framework an arbitrarily fast telephone line. So what he's saying is that Weinberg's theory is inconsistent in the sense that it allows you to transmit information faster than light. And this is, of course, a problem and something that should not happen. And like the message of all this is that it is difficult to modify quantum theory. So it's really difficult. Yeah?
That's actually not an inconsistency. It may disagree with observation.
Yeah, I agree. It's not
especially
a
especially if it's a non-relativistic theory that was modified.
Yes. So it's not inconsistent in itself, but it's something that we didn't expect and that poses problems. So you might still ask, can we have modifications which do not have this feature? Right. And this comes out to be difficult. So it's clear that these two questions are somehow related. So any progress that you make on answering why do we have the Hilbert space formalism will help all these other questions, how do you modify this? And now the results that I talk about with Lewis are a derivation of the full quantum formalism in cooperation with physical axioms on the one hand. So what full quantum formalism means, I'll tell you in a few slides more in detail. Then also methods to construct natural modifications of quantum theory. And yeah, this is still work in progress, so it's not like you can just write down those modifications in the afternoon, but it's kind of clear from the results here on how you might try to get consistent modifications. And yeah, we have not been the first one to do this. So this is based to a large extent on Lucien Hardy's work on quantum theory from five reasonable axioms. So maybe the picture is unnecessary because Lucien is in the audience.
To see my
But we used a lot of results from this paper. And also from the other one by Dakic and Brugner from 2009. So let me say that this paper has a few loopholes, but also many important ideas that we used in our proof. And there's a later paper by Giulio Chiribella, which is also very interesting, where he has the same similar results, not the same one, from a different point of view. So here's an overview of what we're doing. So we start with some physical assumptions, which are very elementary. At least we believe that they're elementary. So this is a laboratory situation, that you have some device, then you can push some button and the device outputs some physical system. Then afterwards, if you want, you can do a transformation, so the system comes in, it comes out on the other side, and in the end you can do a measurement, for example. So maybe a yes-no measurement with two outcomes. And so we have something like states here, like transformations and measurements. And we assume that the measurements have certain outcome probabilities. So these are measurements that are not deterministic, but they can have yes or no with a certain probability. And then if we have more than one system, I'll tell you more about that afterwards, actually, then we assume a condition called the no-signaling condition, which is basically avoiding the problem that Weinberg's theory has. So we want to avoid that you can send superluminal signals in a sense. And I'll say more about this in a minute. So if you assume this here, if you write down what this actually means mathematically, then you get the framework of general probabilistic theories. And this is a very general mathematical framework which contains classical probability theory and quantum theory as special cases, but also many of the other theories like Boxworld and some other theories that have been studied before. In fact, these are infinitely many theories, like there's a continuum of different possible theories, and they don't have Hilbert space from the beginning, so there are no Hilbert spaces, there are no complex numbers in that from the beginning. It turns out that the state spaces are something like this, so arbitrary complex sets. And if you combine two systems, there are still different ways to do that. And the tensor product of quantum mechanics is just one example for this. Now what we have are the axioms that we apply. So in addition to these assumptions here, we have five axioms, and they are local homography, reversibility, subspace axiom. These are the most important ones, but also two others that are not so important, actually. They are so natural that some people don't even mention them, even though they use it. But I'll tell you in a minute what they mean. And then if you assume that they are also true in addition, then it turns out that quantum theory and classical probability theory are the only two theories that survive. So every other theory here, like Boxworld and so on, must violate at least one of the axioms. So you can ask, good, but don't we live in a quantum world? So what about classical probability theory? Can we get rid of that as well?
Yeah.
And the answer is yes.
Well, I didn't mean to interrupt you in mid-sentence.
No, just...
So what about something like quantum field theory? Does that fit into this framework?
In general, it does fit into this framework because this framework contains all C-star algebras, for example. So, but in the talk, I only...
Well, I meant the framework of your reaction.
Yeah, then it doesn't, because this is all about finite dimensional state spaces only. So we're considering only finite dimensional Hilbert spaces in this sense here. And then quantum field theory is normally about
it. Oh, it's not, okay, yeah, so finite dimension is a technical thing, but I mean, what plays the role of these boxes and buttons and so on in quantum field theory?
Well, very good question. I don't know, I think, yeah. It's more like a picture of general measurements, general transformations. These transformations could just be local unitaries, for example, which you can also have in quantum field theory. Of course, the laboratory picture is a bit misleading in this situation. Yeah. But I don't think it's restricted to exactly a laboratory situation here. But it's finite dimensional here, so this is a restriction. Okay. So we might ask, good, can we get rid of classical probability theory as well? And the answer is yes, we can. If we talk about continuous reversibility instead of reversibility, then only quantum theory is the only theory that survives in the end. Now, the interesting speculation is, or a thing that you might try, that you say, okay, so we have these five axioms that rule out quantum theory. What if I drop one of those, or weaken one of those axioms? So do I still only get quantum theory, or maybe not? So maybe there are other solutions. others than quantum theory. And these might be theories that we don't know yet, but that we can try to construct from these axioms. And they might actually be mathematically very different from quantum theory, but then conceptually, in a sense, they are the closest possible theories to quantum theory in a way. So this is the hope that, in the end, we can also find those new candidates here. Good. So I told you now what our results are, so let me tell you what they are not. And so what we cannot do here is like offer a resolution of the measurement problem. So this is still, we have a measurement and then everything's finished and we're not talking about what happens during the measurement. And also we have no new interpretation of quantum theory here. So these are questions that you do not want to address, right? Also, it's not really an easy guess. It's not that you sit down for one afternoon and surely you can confirm this, I guess. And Lucien as well, so you have to work for some time to prove that quantum theory is the only solution. And then you can also ask, well, but where do probabilities come from in the first place? But this is also a question that we do not want to ask. So we just assume that you have events that happen with a certain probability. Then it's also only about abstract quantum theory, so there's no time, no space, no Hamiltonians, and no mechanics built in here. So we don't talk about Lagrangians and space-time, something like this. And this can, I mean, this is not a problem in itself, because conceptually you can just say, okay, let's compare the situation with statistical mechanics, classical statistical mechanics. And classical statistical mechanics consists of mechanics on the one hand, but then also probability theory, like two different aspects, and you can say, okay, I can of course study probability theory on its own without referring to Hamiltonians and space and time. Also in quantum mechanics, you can say, okay, we have some mechanics built in, but let's look only at abstract quantum theory, that's what we're interested here, which talks only about density matrices and complex numbers, the Born rule, but not about a Hamiltonian, for example.
But you still have maps, they still have positive maps.
Yes, yes.
You have a kind of time evolution.
Right. In this sense, you start at some time with your preparation and some later time with your measurement, but you're not really saying how long that takes. So you have some kind of time, but not really physical space time.
I have to throw in that this is abstracting a particular sort of quantum theory, which is the kind that's based on Hamiltonian mechanics. It's not based on the past integral or history's formulas.
That's true.
That would lead probably to a different abstraction.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. Yeah. I mean, this is also the kind of formulation that quantum information theory people are most familiar with. But you can also take the point of view that there's still some more fundamental theory below it that we don't know yet. And this talks about this part of quantum theory that arises as an approximation from this. This might be possible.
Right, but I'm saying even at the level of quantum materials, we know it. There are different formulations, and this is prejudicing. This is biased towards a particular one of them, as opposed to another one.
Yes, in a sense of this. I mean, in other senses, there might be equivalences between those formulations. I'm not sure. But you're right. So this talks only about Hamiltonian formulation. Okay. So the physical assumptions that we have, I already told you that we have preparation, transformation, measurement. And the first question that we can try to answer is, what is a state? And from an operational point of view, a state enables you to predict outcomes of future measurements. So you say, okay, you have this state, and if I later try to make this measurement, what will be the probability of obtaining yes, for example? And what you can do is say, okay, let's just collect all outcome probabilities of all possible measurements in one vector. Like this is the probability of the first measurement giving me yes, probability of the second measurement, and so on. Yeah, and this, in principle, captures all the information you can have about your physical system. And sometimes it turns out that a lot of this information is unnecessary. And that those states here actually span only a finite dimensional subspace. For example, for a quantum bit, a spin 1/2 particle, you only need to know what the probability is of spin up in x direction and in y direction and z direction, and maybe the probability of finding the particle at all. And then you have four real numbers that perfectly determine your state. This means that these states actually span a four-dimensional subspace. And it's enough to give four numbers in R to the fourth in this sense, which then define the state.
Mm-hmm. This is a question. The notion of span is a linear notion, but yes. This is the first time you introduced the notion of a structure, of a linear structure.
Yeah, very good comment. So actually, what you do is you say, this you can find in a book by Hollywood on statistical aspects of quantum theory, where he starts with exactly this and says, okay, how do we want to represent our states? Then we can choose to represent them such that if we mix them probabilistically, that this is linear. Like I take the one-half mixture of two states, and this should be linear. And in this sense, the linearity of probabilities induces the linearity in your state space. You don't have to do this, but it's kind of natural choice to do.
But you have done it in order to make this statement. Well, you haven't made a general statement yet.
Yes. So here I've kind of put in that this P1 really means a probability, like a frequency in the long run of measurement outcomes, and then if I do a mixture of two states, then it's a linear mixture. But this is an assumption, right?
Good.
In general, we cannot be sure that this is always true, that finitely many parameters are sufficient. But for the moment, let's assume this. So as one of the axioms that we have is that all state spaces are finite dimensional. So we limit ourselves to considering only those state spaces where finitely many parameters are sufficient to specify a state.
When you say finite dimensional, you already include there like the linearity of this space.
Yes. I mean, in a sense, what I'm telling you here is not mathematically 100% sound. Otherwise, I'd have to talk about linear ordered spaces. So I'm trying to build it up a bit from intuition, but basically it's as you said. Okay. And this, I already said, so if you have two possible states that you can prepare, the idea is that you can prepare also a probabilistic mixture. So you throw a coin or some dice and you prepare one of the two with probability 1/2. And if you look at the outcome statistics, that what you get in the end is basically the convex combination of the two states. And this motivates to say that, what are the possible states that we have? So these are convex sets. Because if we have two states, we know that also the convex mixtures of the states exist. So we have convex sets, actually compact convex sets. And then the extremal points can be called pure states, and the other states can be called mixed, same as in quantum theory.
This is also to do with this linear structure. Mm-hmm. If you do this yourself, then you know what state you're preparing. So is the idea that someone else does it, and you don't know what they've done, and they just present you this?
Yes.
So it's a kind of game theory approach to understanding states? How would you characterize it?
The picture I have in mind about this is that you have here your preparation system is a black box, and press a button and then one state comes out. You can do this as often as you want. So this gives you the possibility to do tomography in the air. And in the box there might be some guy sitting and throwing dice and then preparing you with this here. And you do not see this guy who takes the decision what state to prepare. You only can push the button once, twice, and three times and so on. And you only see the statistics of your measurement outcomes. And then you see the state. That's,
But if you built the box, you would know what was happening inside.
Depends on how this guy in the box is throwing his coins, right? So, as I said, it's one assumption of what we did, that you really have indeterminism, where you have probabilities that, in the sense of probability theory, and this might be here in this box, and then you get the convex combination of the outcomes.
So you just willingly forego knowing certain information that you could know.
Yes.
In order to do it.
Yes. You could know what the outcome was of this particular experiment, but you say, okay, maybe I don't, and then in effect I get this state.
It's not like the uncertainty principle where you couldn't know. It's just that you decide, I will not know.
Yeah. It's interesting that in the end, quantum theory is also captured from this. But you get theories where you do have uncertainty and also the other quantum aspects. So this is also kind of in this framework. It's just not built in from the beginning directly. Okay, so what are now measurements? So measurements have several outcomes, and we have these outcomes have probabilities, and the probabilities should also be linear with respect to those mixtures. So this means that outcome probabilities must be linear functionals, which are between 0 and 1 for every state. So you put in a state, you get out some probability, and if you draw this picture, then you get these lines or hyperplanes, which show you the states with the same probability. For example, the states on this line, there's actually only this one, has probability 1, the one here down has probability 0, and these states on this line have probability 0.7 maybe. And then a measurement, a k outcome measurement, is just a collection of k of those, and they add up to 1. Now the total probability should be the identity. And one thing that we have as an axiom is that actually all measurements that you can write down can be done in principle. You might think that maybe for some reason physics prevents you from building some devices, because if you build them, they collapse to black holes or something like this, right? And we don't want this. So we say, okay, let's just assume whatever I can write down as a measurement actually can be done in principle.
Can you clarify this? So in the paper you say all mathematically possible measurements are physically possible. So what constitutes mathematically possible, that it gives probabilities between 0 and 1?
That it's linear, that it gives probabilities between 0 and 1.
And then my worry is, maybe we should come back to this and get it all about.
So, do you have to introduce any notion of locality here, anywhere, right?
It comes in two or three slides. Yes.
So these measurements, you know, all non-local measurements are also possible.
Yes.
So yes. Maybe some kind of measurement.
So that's a good point that you raised. I mean, this is an axiom because this is, in fact, an assumption. We assume that we can do all skew, strange, entangled measurements.
Even if they're non-local. I mean, you don't have locality yet. But when it will come with, you know, all the non-local measurements.
Right. Even for 1,000 parties of entangled measurement, we always assume it can be done in principle.
In a paper you said it was for a generalized bit.
Oh, yes.
Here you just say, you don't say that you don't have that.
Oh, good qualification. So I'm not saying this to keep it simple, but you're completely right. So it's enough to assume this for a generalized bit. If it's true for a bit, then you can prove with the other axioms that it's true for all states. Right. So you could weaken this a bit.
Mm-hmm. Have a similar concern about these axioms.
Yeah.
So because shouldn't be the fact that a measurement is physically possible, shouldn't it be part of the definition of what a measurement is? This is something that you can do physically. So in what sense this is an axiom?
Yeah. So let me go back a bit.
That the word measurement here means something that maybe is not, that could not be done in the lab.
So the main reason for having this is that the other axioms talk about measurements.
Yeah.
And we want to have axioms that talk about physics. So the other axioms should talk about physical measurements. But then some of them cannot be done, then it doesn't fit together very well.
So the word measurement doesn't mean physical measurement. It means mathematically allowed.
You can choose any function for the free. You can choose any kind of function free.
Right.
This means so.
Yeah. So it's a bad formulation because I want to keep it simple, but it means all mathematically possible measurements are also physically possible.
Yeah.
And mathematically possible means just the same stuff.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we have physical system, let's give them letters like A, and then state spaces that correspond to them like omega A, for example. And we still have to talk about transformations. And transformations has a state going in and a state going out. So it maps states to states. And also has to respect probabilistic mixtures, and this is why it should be linear. Then there's a particular kind of transformations, which are the reversible ones, such as ones that you can invert. Yeah, there's T inverse. And they form a group. And in quantum theory, the reversible transformations are just the unitaries acting on the density matrices. And it's clear that they must map the state space onto itself as a bijection, a one-to-one map. And in the case of the strange state space that I have here, this might be, for example, these rotations, like 120-degree rotations, which maps omega to t omega, even another transformation, but this preserves the state space, so it's a symmetry of the state space. But then, not every symmetry that you discover may be physically allowed. And the qubit is a simple example of this, because a quantum bit spin one half particle is just a three-dimensional unit ball, a Bloch ball, and but the group that you can actually do is SO3, so these are just the rotations. You cannot do reflections because a reflection is not completely positive. In the end, this means that if you specify a system, then this is always a pair of a state space and a group of reversible transformations. Giving those two pieces of information specifies your system, your physical system like this one. And one of the axioms that we have, which is very important, is the reversibility axiom. It says that if we have two pure states, phi and omega, then there must be a reversible transformation which maps phi to omega. This is an assumption that we have. And so what does it mean? Well, it enforces some symmetry in your state space. For example, a quantum bit clearly satisfies this because it's just a ball. The pure states are the sphere, and by rotations you can map every point in the sphere to every other. But the strange state space that I had, this does not satisfy this axiom because here are two pure states, and there's no symmetry that you can do that would map the one state to the other. But then, for example, a square would still be fine because there are only four pure states, and by rotations and reflections you can map every one to the other. Good. So this is, of course, motivated by the fact that physics seems to be reversible. So in classical mechanics in closed systems, and quantum mechanics in closed systems, time evolution is always reversible. So maybe it makes sense to demand this kind of, and maybe even future theories will have the fact that the property of being reversible in a way, as long as we do not measure it.
Is this a statement about that middle box T? Is that what it's about?
This one, yes.
That
yes.
Axiom refers to the properties of T.
Right. So it also tells you that if you have a fixed preparation device, so this is fixed, then you can always choose a transformation that produces every state you want afterwards. So you just start quantum theory, you start with some state, then you can do a unitary and you can get any other state in your system. And it says that this should be possible always. Last assumption is about locality. So suppose we have Alice and Bob, SpongeBob, and they have both a laboratory and both some state. And then of course what happens is they form a joint system and they can have a state which is correlated among the two. And we should keep in mind that both of them have measurement devices that they can choose to measure, maybe X and Y for Alice and X and Y for Bob. This is the same as the usual Bell inequality setup here. And then the no signaling condition, which is always assumed here in this framework, says that Alice's probabilities should not depend on Bob's choice of measurement. So suppose that Bob choosing X or Y, if Bob chooses X, for example, this will be different for Alice from Bob choosing Y. So Alice sees a difference in probabilities, then Bob can use it to send signals to Alice with arbitrary large speed, even if they are far away from each other. This would be superluminal signaling. And this condition rules that out. It says we assume or we demand that our theories are not signaling. And so this rules out the Weinberg problem that I talked at the beginning, right from the start.
Mm-hmm. So can you express the Weinberg's theorem? I mean, the Weinberg's modification in the language of probabilistic.
Good question. I don't know, actually. As to be honest, I have no idea. It will be a signaling theory. Yeah. So it will not satisfy this assumption. So it will not be a standard part of the framework that I'm talking about. And to have signaling theory seems to be also a bit difficult. I think Peter Janotta worked a bit on that, how you could do this. But I don't know if you can do this. I don't know if it fits in this framework. Okay. We also demand something else. So we say this one axiom that the states that Alice and Bob have, the global states, are uniquely determined by correlations of local measurements on A and B. So what this means, it means that you have local tomography. So if Alice and Bob share some strange state and they have many copies and they want to find out what state it is, all that they need to do is to do local measurements and then afterwards compare their outcomes to see correlations. And that's all they need. So there is no need to have some strange non-local measurements on both of them together, but they can do it separately to do tomography of a state. And if you write down what this means mathematically, that you don't need those non-local measurements, then it tells you that it gives you the tensor product structure. So it tells you that the state space of AB lives actually in the tensor product of A and B. So you recover the tensor product structure of quantum classical mechanics. Okay. So I told you about this here. So we have states, transformations, measurements, outcome probabilities, no signaling. Then I tried to explain to you that we get this framework with convex state spaces, no Hilbert spaces, but convex sets. And still, there are many ways to combine systems. And now the axioms. So I told you earlier about these axioms. So local tomography, reversibility, finite dimensionality, and no measurements forbidden. And there's one remaining, which is the subspace axiom, which I will try to explain to you now. So what does the subspace axiom say? So suppose you have a physical system which has three levels. It's some three-level system, maybe three energy levels, or three boxes where you can put a ball, for example. And suppose for some reason it is impossible to put your particle in the third level. Now maybe it's constructed in a way that whenever you look at it, you never find the particle in the third system. So what does it mean? Well, it means in effect that it's a two-level system, right? So it should be the same as a two-level system. And formally, in quantum theory, this just means that if you have the density matrices which have a zero here as an entry, then there must all be zeros left and up. And basically, you get a 2x2 density matrix. Classical probability theory is even simpler. If your third probability is zero, you have just two probabilities left. And this is, of course, very, very important because if this would make a difference, then physics would be very, very difficult because then otherwise some impossible potentialities like having this impossible state would modify your state space. Yeah. They say, well, my particle is in a unicorn state with probability zero, and this modifies my state space. And this is, of course, highly unlikely, and physics would really be hard.
Mm-hmm. So in what sense would you consider it meaningful to say that this is actually a three-level system, if the third level is inaccessible, if it can never be that case?
But formally, you can say, let's look at the set of all states on this three-level system without the zero here, like all the 3x3 density matrices, and then let's look at the subset of those where this has probability zero. So the subset of density matrices where this entry is exactly zero. And then this turns out to be a block matrix with 2x2 entry.
It's not so much that it's impossible, it's just that you consider the restriction of those states, so those states where it doesn't happen.
Yeah. It might have some very small probability instead of being impossible. And then the restriction of all sets of states to those states gives you something which looks like a two-level system.
You know, could you say that you have like a three-level system, but then you consider only the states, mm-hmm. For which the third probability is? Right?
Yes.
Even though some states do have probability there.
Yes.
So you're going to consider only the smaller set.
Yeah, right. That's and exactly this.
This section tells you, like, if you consider only the smaller set, it is the same as if you only have.
Just
to begin with. But some
mistakes will happen. Yeah, exactly. Right, that's exactly right. Yeah. And this is the formal way, to formalize it, is this axiom here. So we have state spaces omega n and omega n minus 1, with systems with capacities n and n minus 1. I'll tell you in a second what capacity means. And if we have a complete measurement of it, then those the subset of states where the last measurement gives outcome probability 0 is equivalent to the state space with capacity n minus 1. So let's look at these notions. So what does capacity mean?
Omega n and omega n minus 1 are any two systems. So
yes.
They don't have to be related to each other.
That's right. Yeah. So
you're implicitly assuming that any two-level system is isomorphic to any other
two-level
system.
So you're exactly right. So I'm actually a bit cheating here. Yeah. So I'm assuming a bit more. This here tells you also that every kind of two-level system, they are all equivalent to each other. So this is true. Capacity is the maximum number of perfectly distinguishable states. For a qubit, it's 2, for example. Perfectly distinguishable means that you have a measurement where the outcome probabilities are just 0 or 1. So EI of omega j is delta ij. And then a complete measurement is just one that distinguishes the maximum number of states. So this here is a complete measurement. It has this property and it distinguishes the maximal number of states. Yeah, in quantum theory, for Neumann measurements with one-dimensional projections, for example. And then equivalent just tells you, okay, equivalence means you have the same state space up to a linear map. Because if you have a ball as a state space or some ellipsoid, it doesn't really matter. They both have the same physics. They give the same outcome probability. So you don't really care about having this or that representation up to equivalence, it's just the same. Yeah. And Cn says that it's equivalent to the state space with one capacity less. Yeah. Good. That's the framework. It's already 40 minutes, but yeah. Let's try to see if we can derive Hilbert spaces from this. So the first question that I'd like to answer with you, and Lucien has done this in his paper also already, is why a bit must be described by a ball? Why is this true? And so we look at a particular state space with capacity 2, call it omega 2. It might be some arbitrary convex set for the moment. Then for every convex set, you will always find one pure or extreme state with some line or hyperplane through it, which only intersects this point. This is called an exposed point, and we can always find such points. And what you do now is we construct a measurement from this line or this hyperplane and say, okay, let's just have the measurement outcome, which has probability 0 on this line, and then probability 1 on the line which is on the other side, and something in between here. And then you consider this outcome and 1 minus that on the other outcome. So this gives you a measurement with 2 outcomes, and it distinguishes this state from the other state perfectly. So it distinguishes 2 states for a bit, and that's a complete measurement. So what does the subspace axiom tell you? It says, okay, if you look at the set of states where one of them has probability 0, then this must be equivalent to the state space with one capacity less, so to omega 1 with capacity 1. And this constructed is only the state omega 0. So if you look at this, this tells you that omega 1 contains only one state. It contains a single state, only. But now, suppose your state space has faces, like for example this one here, or that one. Then you can just do the same thing again, but now you choose your line parallel to the face. And then the same reasoning will give you that omega 1 contains infinitely many states, namely all those states here. And this is a contradiction. Yeah, so faces are impossible. We cannot have faces for a bit. So your bit has no faces, and it might look maybe like a droplet, for example, like this rod here, which has no faces. Yeah. But we have additional information. So we know that every pure state can be mapped to every other by a symmetry. And this is not true for this droplet. So the point here up here cannot be mapped to this on the bottom, for example. And if you ask group representation theory, it tells you that actually it must be a ball or an ellipsoid. So it will be something which is equivalent to a ball. And this is why a bit is described by a ball. And we do not know what the dimension of the ball is, and this will be the next question. Okay. So then afterwards you do a few lemmas and you go through some properties of that. So first you say, okay, there's a maximally mixed state, which doesn't change if I apply reversible transformation. And on a joint system, this is just the tensor product. Then you prove that you can always decompose it in perfectly distinguishable states, and the capacities are multiplicative. And then we use an argument by Lucy and Hardy to prove that the dimension of the ball of the bit must be with the form 2 to the r minus 1. This follows from these results with a bit of work. So it's either one dimensional or three dimensional, or 7, 15, 31, and so on. And so what if it's 1? So what is a one dimensional ball? Well, one dimensional ball is a line segment, so it's this one. And this is a classical bit, because you have 0 here and 1 over there, and then all the mixtures of it. And if you have this, and look at the state spaces with higher capacities, it's easy to prove that all the other state spaces must be simplices. So they all must be simplex, and this is classical probability theory. The reversible transformations must be the full permutation group. Yeah, and this is, again, classic probability theory for finite linear outcomes. So we know what happens in the case of dimension 1 here. Yes?
Just a technical question. Is there some assumption of compactness or closure of some of these spaces?
Yes. State space is assumed to be closed because you say, well, if we can prepare a state almost perfectly, then that's good. Yeah, then this is a state. And reversible transformation is also assumed to be topologically closed as a group. This is part of the framework. Yeah. And this is actually used here. So if we look at the higher dimensional theories, we know that the group is transitive on the sphere because it maps every point to every other one. And then you can look at a paper, for example, by Onyshchik in 1963, who tells you what groups have this property. He classifies all those groups. Says, okay, the compact connected transitive groups on the sphere, if D is even, the dimension is even, then there are many possibilities, like SU of D over 2. But fortunately, these are all odd numbers, so we can get rid of this possibility. If the dimension is odd and not 7, then it's the orthogonal group. If the dimension is 7, it's the orthogonal group or the exceptional E group G2. So, and 7 is indeed a possibility. So, something strange is going on here. Yes. So it's just made a lot of work because you have to look at the seven-dimensional case. Yeah, in addition, or it's a special case. Yeah. Okay. So how can we rule out 7, 15, and 31 dimensions? That's the next question. So let's look at two bits. So two bits are some kind of tensor product between those balls. We don't know which one. But what we do know is that we can do local transformations. So we can do the group on one bit, the group on the other bit. And let's disregard the seven-dimensional case for the moment. Just look at D different from 7, okay? There are those local transformations are orthogonal transformations. So we can rotate this one, we can rotate that one independently. Yeah, so that's what we can do. But now let's look at two particular states. So the first bit, choose states omega 0 and omega 1 to antipodal points, and do that also here. And then look at the tensor product omega 0 tensor omega 0, this one, and omega 1 tensor omega 1. So these two states are perfectly distinguishable from each other because you can do this by local measurement. And so they generate again a bit. So they are on a face of your state space, or like a subspace. So we're using the subspace axiom here. And it tells you that actually the face generated by those two is again a bit, so it must be again a ball. But then, of course, this is not changed if I do here a local rotation, which preserves this axis. And I do there a rotation, which also preserves this axis, it stabilizes the space. And so let's just do all these rotations and look at the orbit. Yeah, so we start with one of the states, or some correlated state, and we do all the local rotations. So what do you get? You can use group representation theory to count the dimension of this orbit. And it turns out that the orbit is just too large for the ball. if the local transformation group acts irreducibly. So if this SOD minus 1 is an irreducible complex group representation, then just doing them all just explores too much of your state space. But this, so this is impossible. But this group is irreducible if and only if, or it's reducible if and only if the relation is free, because then it's abelian. Yeah. And so this is the reason, or some reason, if you might call it like this, why Bloch-Bohr three-dimensional. So the kind of take-home message here is that Bloch-Bohr is three-dimensional because, in a sense, SOD minus 1 is reducible only if D equals 3. Okay, and this is the main, the most difficult part. And afterwards, you have to work a bit more. You map your sphere to the Hamilton matrices. You do this for every tensor factor. Use some results on universal quantum computation, witness theorem, some other things. And then you prove that actually you get quantum theory. So every theory which satisfies the five axioms, except classical probability theory, is equivalent to the state space omega n in the group G, and the state space accept the density matrices on n-dimensional complex space. And Gn is the group of unitaries which act by conjugation. And the measurements must be the POVMs, so the positive operator value measures, like the von Neumann measurements, for example. So this you prove. So that's kind of the way you saw it. And maybe for 5 more minutes, if you like, I can tell you a bit of speculation about what you might find beyond quantum theory. So again, the idea is you have these 5 axioms, and they give you quantum theory. But then let's drop one of those, for example, local tomography, or one of the others. Actually, reversibility is good because it gives you a lot of interesting dynamics, and that's something we expect from our universe. So you might not want to drop reversibility. Local tomography gives you a tensor product, and this is very useful. So for the moment, you might not want to drop that as well. But the subspace axiom is very complicated, so let's drop this for a moment and see what happens. And there's one result by Luis Massanes and David Perez Garcia, which is not published yet, which is work in progress. What they do is they show, okay, even if you get rid of the subspace axiom and assume that the local state spaces are balls of dimension D, then you only get entanglement and continuous reversibility if the dimension is 3. So in this bipartite case, for continuous reversibility for balls, you again get just the quantum correlations. And this is something that they're writing up at the moment. It was very interesting. But still, you might ask, good, what if I don't have balls? Or maybe not continuous reversibility, maybe it's discrete in some realm of physics that we have yet to discover. And then you can look at properties of possible theories which satisfy 1 and 2, the axioms 1 and 2, for example. So this is now work in progress with Oscar Dahlsten and Vlad Kovedra. We just try to compute properties of the possible post-quantum theories which satisfy 1 and 2 and which are finite dimensional. And you can do a lot there already because you have interesting dynamics. You can generalize the notion of a Pauli operator, for example, and of purity to such theories. For purity, what you do is you say, okay, this is my state space. Here's the maximally mixed state. And let's purity just be the length of your vector. So maximally mixed state has purity 0, the pure states have purity 1, and the others have something in between. And then you can, for example, prove this here. So you have, for example, on AB, on a joint system, you draw a pure state randomly, and then you look at only at the states at Ellis's side, and then the expected purity of Ellis's half of the state is exactly this equation. So that's okay, is the state space dimension, and n is the capacity. So this tells you that it doesn't really matter so much what these state spaces look like, so these results depend only on two quantities that are attached to the state spaces. And for classical probability theory, your state space dimension is just the same as the capacity. So k equals n, and then everything cancels, right? So you get 1 here. So this means if you have a global pure state, then locally it's also pure. this just tells you that there's no entanglement in quantum in classical probability theory. In a quantum theory, capacity is n squared. So the Hilbert space dimension square is the number of parameters in the density matrix. And then you get something smaller than 1 here, which tells you that typically states are highly entangled, if you draw them at random, for example.
So this is, well, it's a bit weird because we don't have even one example of a theory beyond quantum theory here. So we don't know if they exist, right? But still we can compute what properties they had if they existed.
So the distributability axiom tells you you can map every pure state to every other, so you have the notion of an invariant measure on the state. And then here you draw the state space in a way such that your reversible transformations are orthogonal. And group representation theory tells you there's a unique one if it's irreducible. And for example, here this is the case. So if you do a reversible transformation, you do here a rotation, which is orthogonal. And then you look at the squared length of your Bloch vector here. Mm-hmm. And this is a unique measure, which...
And you assume it to be uniform in the
length. Yes, right, since every pure state can map every other, and they are orthogonal, they must have the same length. The pure states, for example, must all have the same length, maybe 1.
Sure, but the prior we give a matrix also on the length of the distance.
Here you assume it's a pure state globally.
Oh.
You draw only pure states for the moment. You can also draw a mixed state and then you have to talk about your question.
Yeah.
And then this describes classical coin tossing as well, but this is another question.
Okay.
So it's the last speculation, but this is really very speculative, so it's work in progress. We're not sure if that works. We try to look at decoupling in those theories. And this, the main motivation for that is the black hole information paradox. So in 2007, there was a paper by Patrick Hayden and John Preskill where they analyze the black hole information paradox in quantum information terms. We have Alice, who throws in her quantum memory, and Bob, who has access to the Hawking radiation. And then the question was, how long does it take for Bob to retrieve Alice's qubits that Alice threw into the black hole at the beginning? And you can do a pretty good analysis on quantum information terms, which goes under the name decoupling, which basically consists of state transfer from Alice to Bob. And this is also used for channel capacities and some other things. And what we're trying to do is we try to come up with a decoupling theorem for those general theories that have one and two as properties only. It seems to work, but I don't know exactly if it will work in the end. Yeah. But I think this makes kind of sense because in this situation, some people believe that some new theory might be relevant, which you don't know yet. So it makes sense to ask, what if it's not quantum theory, but something else? How does this behave here? Well, let's hope that this works in the end.
Okay, that's it. Thanks. Is there any questions?
Yes.
Yeah, so just to...
Sorry, go ahead.
Okay, to come back to the seven-dimensional case,
mm-hmm.
Does that have anything to do with the possibility of Bartolian Newtonians?
Good question. I also asked me this question, but I never looked at this. Might be. It has to do with state space or Bartolomeic algebra. I don't know. So I don't know anything about this. Might be.
Yeah, at some point you had, I don't know that you had, but you had something about two analogy things.
Actually, you had an exceptional Lie group there. One of them is kind of a G2.
Right?
Oh, G2, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't appear here if you just apply the axioms, right? But then you can ask, what about quaternionic quantum theory? And I'm just not an expert on Watsonian quantum theory, but it seems to have some strange features which are not shared by this general probabilistic framework. Like, if you have two, like Alice and Bob, and then the temporal order between having Alice doing her measurement and Bob doing his measurement, it matters in what temporal order that happens. Mm-hmm. I guess, as far as I understand. And this is not true for this framework. So I guess it's not in this framework, but I'm not sure about this.
You have more? No, that's fine. That was so just a general question. There are other kind of reconstruction approaches. I'm just wondering about the, for example, there's one that Mackey pursued, and I maybe Stan Gutter, and I'm not quite sure all the other people who were involved in that, which seems in some way rather similar, but in detail it's very different. Can you say something about the relationship to those?
Yeah, I also wondered about this for quite some time. I mean, it's also like Ludwig in the 50s already who did something like this. I don't know exactly. My impression is that people in the last century, they concentrated on the infinite dimensional case because it was not clear at this time that finite dimensional theories give you already a lot of quantum theory, or that they're actually interesting. So this is what makes them technically more difficult, also more difficult to read. So yeah, what I tried to read was like, what's it called again? So if you can classify all state spaces of C-star algebras, for example. This has been done by some people, and the name I forgot now. So, sorry. But, for example, if you look what they did, then they say, if this, that, and the other condition holds, then it's a C-star algebra. But one of the conditions is the three-dimensionality of the ball as a face. As a physicist, you might ask, why should it be a three-dimensional ball? Shouldn't be there some physical reason? So it's more a mathematical result with another emphasis on finite dimensional systems, I guess. But I don't know exactly what's in what Ludwig did or Mackey, for example.
Yeah, I mean, some of them are a little closer to this than what you're describing. They imagine a set of possible measurements, a set of states. I'm not sure they have transformations as an explicit part of the framework.
I'm not sure.
And they have some lattice of possible measurements or questions. And then they prove it has to be an ortho, a modular lattice. And then add some little, ultimately you add some little thing and then you get the
That's a good question. I don't know. Whenever I talk to Volker Scholz, he says, well, this has been all done before. And he refers me to the work you just mentioned. But when I look at the papers that he gives me, then it's always a bit hidden, or three-dimensionality is just assumed, and so on. I'm not quite sure.
So when I read the paper, the axiom I didn't like most was the one that you thought, one of the ones you put in faint, which was the sort of the existence of all, all measurements. So this, for example, immediately rules out things like the Speckens toy model, I assume, because that's a tetrahedron. And I suppose what worries me is if there's some kind of self-referential with nature to it. So you could say, well, all measurements that are mathematically consistent with the postulates are allowed. But then if you could write down a consistent set of postulates for, say, the Speckens toy model, then clearly you have a consistent set of measurements. So I'm worried that there's sort of some problem with self-referentiality.
So perhaps
you'd say, well, you know, you have a mathematical definition to what that means, but then really it's not an operational axiom; it's more of a mathematical axiom.
I agree to some extent. I mean, I think the best answer is to go into a definition and do it mathematically, because in a way it just says that you do not want to add extra structure. So what I assume always is that here state space, omega A, and then your group of reversible transformations, G A. And once you specify those, you get everything from that. But then this is, so we do this. And then the other possibility would be that you said, okay, I specify the state space, the group of transformations, and then the group of, or the set of measurements, like the cone of subcone of the dual cone of positive effects, for example, that's, I don't know, measurements. Okay. And this gives you more freedom than that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but we choose this one, which kind of says, once you know the state space, everything follows. Yeah, except for the group of transformations. So we only have to know those. So
okay.
Mathematically, it's not self-referential because you really define that this is our framework. And then, so this is consistent, right?
Okay.
But of course, it's right what you say, that this is not very operational. So maybe the fifth axiom is in fact, the least operational one.
Okay.
I guess it can be equivalently stated in terms of one axiom of Julio about maximum mix, but it's a different kind of maximum mix that you have.
Yes, slightly different. So in that case, I would agree with the Lucian's comment that this axiom is stating that some mathematical definition corresponds to something physical.
Yes.
It contains words from two different worlds.
Mm-hmm.
The words of mathematics, what is mathematically allowed, and what is physically possible. Because if you interpret it within the world of physics, it's kind of a tautology. Every measurement is physical. That is what I was saying before.
I mean, you can also take the point of view of leave it out, but then the other measurements, like local tomography, your local measurements, they just refer to measurements that you could have in principle.
Mm-hmm.
So to have this just ensures that the measurements we talk about here are actual physical measurements. But then, I mean, in principle, you cannot build every measurement device at all. So you could as well say, let's just talk about maps that have outcome probabilities between 0 and 1, their properties.
But that's still the same. I mean, that's just, I think that's sort of tricks with words. It seems to me that doesn't do the job. I mean, because other people have to have quite substantial axioms to do the same thing. So, for example, Bruckner and Dakic have this axiom that you can write down any state as a mixture of two distinguishable states for a generalized bit.
Right.
The same is true. Like, I have to have simplicity axiom to serve this purpose. So it's a fairly meaty, it's a fairly substantial amount of work that this is doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my
question. Just from a mathematical point of view, my impression is that this is very weak, so it's of course weaker than, for example, Dakic and Bruckner's axiom, that you can always write as a mixture of two distinguishable states, because the one follows from the other, but not the other from this one. So this is weaker, and this was, it might be operationally less, like, you might not like it that much, and I agree with that. But from a mathematical point of view, if you write down the assumptions, what they mean mathematically, it's less.
Okay.
That's why you kind of like this. Yeah. But you're right. So we also tried for quite some time to get rid of this, but we weren't able to. We can almost, but in the end, you cannot.
There's always something.
Yeah.
So this is just thrown out from what you said. To what extent is your intention that given just the state space and the group of transformations, that there be that everything else be symmetric on the group of transformations.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that would be a way to say something without a reference to measurement. Because you don't want any structures which are not, I don't know what precise the wording is, which are not, and then they reduce the word representation of the transformation group or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you write down something like this, this already applies in a way that your measurements that you have also have these symmetries. So that's what you said. And so our hope was that this already lets you prove that this contains all measurements, but this is not true. But it gives you some structure. So this is, you need those symmetries in your effect space as well.
I would suggest that we may conclude here the formal part of the seminar, and then we continue, and who's interested to remain for a discussion with Marcus can remain after this part. So I suggest to thank Marcus again for his